All right, at this time, then, we'll proceed with the next case. This is in the matter of the appeal of an implicated individual. It's appeal number 29473. Marty Jackley appears and will be arguing on behalf of the appellant. Jeffrey Beck and John Arneson are appearing on behalf of appellees. My understanding, Mr. Beck and Mr. Arneson, you've split your time up. So, Mr. Beck, you'll have 5 minutes, and Mr. Arneson will have 10 minutes. Other way around. Mr. Beck, 10.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Arneson, 5.
Okay.
All right. Before we start, let me just say that, as the parties are aware, I just want to remind counsel that both sides stipulated in this case to seal the entire file, including the briefs, and the court entered an order on November 9th of 2020 pursuant to that stipulation, sealing the entire file. At this time, the file still remains sealed. However, the oral arguments are set for this morning are open to the public and are being live streamed. As such, the substantive arguments of the parties from the briefs are fair game, and the parties can certainly refer to those. However, I would direct the parties to refrain from identifying the names of any implicated individual in the search warrant affidavits or the search warrants themselves, including any identifying information. With that, then, Mr. Jackley, you may proceed with your argument. You have 15 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, counsel, the issue before this court today is this court's authority to seal or redact search warrant information. The facts of this case are very simple. You have before you an uncharged individual that's never been arrested. There's never been a complaint filed, an information, or an indictment. That the state that applied for the search warrant has openly admitted the search warrant is an error in that it refers to the individual as a defendant in a criminal case. The facts further are that this investigation has not been officially terminated and that the trial court initially accepted the state's request to seal the search warrant documentation. The uncharged individual is asking this court to harmonize the statute and the court rule in this case, specifically 23A-35-4.1 and the court rules under STCL 15-15A for two particular reasons. Number one, to avoid the constitutional separation of powers issue, and number two, to avoid absurd results. The court has both constitutional and inherent authority over its own records, specifically, as this court is well aware, under Article 2 of the South Dakota Constitution, separation of powers, as well as Article 5, Section 12, with its rulemaking authority. The Nixon decision, which was literally 8 days ago, reaffirmed significantly by the Eighth Circuit in a decision written by Judge Grunder, specifically stated, quote, every court has supervisory power over its own records and files. The uncharged individual is asking this court to specifically look at the analysis that the New Hampshire Supreme Court went through with respect to a state statute that sealed divorce-related affidavits and information. That New Hampshire Supreme Court avoided the separation of powers issue by allowing the court rules and the statutes to coexist. Specifically, that New Hampshire Supreme Court retained ultimate authority over access to its records, which is what the uncharged individual is asking this court to do, which, by our interpretation, SCCL 15-15A does precisely that.
Mr. Jackley, you've mentioned earlier this morning, I think this is where you're headed. It's in your briefs. It's the centerpiece of your argument. It's this overarching idea that the statute 23A-35-4.1 can be read, as you say, in harmony with the rules contained in Chapter 15-15A. But as I read your argument, I'm not so sure if they can be harmonized, or if your argument contemplates that we give preeminence to the 1515A rules, and in a case such as this, overlook what would otherwise be the text of a statute. So to me, I don't know if that's harmony or that's just one supplanting the other. And if it's harmony, I was going to try to get your thoughts on how they could be read together, or is it an either-or proposition, not really harmony at all?
I think you could look at it, Justice Salter, both ways. But the reason I use the word harmony is because if you look closely at 15-15A, it talks about, and the trial judge looked at the reference, the general reference to other statutes. And I think when you look at ultimately that, specifically 15-15A-5 as well as Section 13, I think that you can harmonize it by recognizing that that sentence, in addition to referencing the statute, says, except as further restricted by 15-15A-7 through Section 13. And I think you do that because the way I read that and the way we urge this court to read it is that you don't have to ultimately declare the statute unconstitutional as applied by the trial court. You can simply have them coexist. And that's really what the New Hampshire court did. It has allowed them to coexist. And then as Justice Salter's second point, what the New Hampshire court said is they'll coexist, but ultimately we, the court, retain ultimate authority over our records. And this court has done that specifically in 15-15A-13 with the ability to seal and redact.
And in a case like this, then, that preeminence would yield the result that, according to your argument, that we don't apply the text of 23A 35.4.1, but rather our own authority as you contemplate it, and we permit them to remain sealed.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Is there a difference between the ability to seal a document and to redact in the context of these statutes that you are referencing? And if so, explain your thoughts on that.
I think ultimately because this court retains the inherent and constitutional authority over its own records, that it has the ability to do both. As I read 15-15A-13, I look at it that the court, as part of its balancing and looking for the least restrictive alternative, could either seal, which is what ultimately was done by the trial court in this case initially, or it could look at it and balance it and perhaps redact, which after the trial court made the determination that the statute prohibited him from sealing, he still was going to allow redactions of some of the very specific information, such as Social Security numbers, IP addresses, and other confidential information. And so there is a difference. Ultimately, I believe this court should leave it sealed, that the trial court made the right decision. It made the initial balancing at the request of the state, not the uncharged individual. That was at a request of the state. It was granted for very obvious reasons, given the nature of what is alleged and what has been looked at.
Is there a redaction issue in front of us? You know, the case, as you point out in your brief, has, you know, maybe a novel procedural history. This is not an adversarial proceeding. This is something that's a search warrant and the related documents that are filed in a search warrant file, and that's where they're kept. But it's not really it doesn't seem to be an adversarial proceeding. But in this case, as you point out in your brief and as the parties know, the inquiry from members of the media prompted the circuit court judge to reflect on his own authority, and then we have what we have, and that's kind of how this all arises. So within that context, it seems to me that the court was defining the issue. Do I have the authority under, given this statute, do I have the authority to do what I have done in this case? And it almost seemed as though That was the sole issue. I wasn't sure. There was a request to redact, but it was unrelated to anything. The request to redact, as you recall, was the state's request to redact the captions. But other than that, it didn't seem like there was ever really a request to redact anything. It was sort of seal or don't seal. Is there a redaction issue in front of us?
I would say yes, for the simple fact that if the statute, as ProPublica argues, is a complete prohibition to sealing and redacting, then this court would not have the inherent authority or the constitutional authority to seal or redact. And redaction is important to the uncharged individual when you have even the state admitting that its search warrant application information is an error because it refers to an uncharged individual in a criminal case as a defendant, which is absolutely not correct. And so if, in fact, that statute is read in isolation and 15-15A dash or section 13 is not allowed to be applied, what will be released is a search warrant that is admitted error. And so that's why I go back to, that's why it's so important that this court maintain its inherent and constitutional authority over its own court records, so that when there are situations like this or the litany of absurd results that can result, one of which, again, goes back to expungement. The state legislature has said under expungement that if you've been arrested and a year has gone by, you can apply to expunge all of your records. Well, search warrants are part of those arrest file and the arrest records. Those would not be able to be expunged based upon the isolated reading that ProPublica wishes for 23A-35-4.1.
But that wouldn't apply here because, of course, there's been no arrest.
Right. And
that remedy would be available to this implicated individual anyway, at least at this point in time.
Right. So under this interpretation, you'd be better off if you were arrested, because then at least you'd have a remedy. But this individual hasn't been arrested. He's an uncharged individual, never been arrested, never been indicted, never had an information or complaint filed. He has no remedy if that statute is read in isolation.
Could there ever be an instance then, back to the harmonizing the rules and the statute, could there ever be an instance then where, given law enforcement's interests, which you've articulated, the Attorney General, as I understand it, has withdrawn its own appeal and then not appeared, it's been a brief here, you've made some of the arguments that I might otherwise expect the Attorney General to make, but would there ever be an instance that you could imagine where the state couldn't articulate some sort of investigatory purpose for prohibiting disclosure of search warrants, the inventory, the return? Doesn't it seem like that'd be most cases? And if that's the case, then does the statute mean anything?
Well, certainly there are those cases. Licken is cited in the briefing. That was a case in which, to bring the court's attention back, in 1971, two girls disappeared. Ultimately, the shoebaker was found. There was originally a criminal charge, an indictment. Then ultimately the Attorney General terminated that investigation. So there are those instances when, you know, certainly in that balancing and in the, you know, ultimately looking at it, and it's what, you know, Grudner in that recent 8 days ago decision in the Eighth Circuit pointed out, the person best capable of making that decision is the presiding judge. The judge adheres the arguments of the parties and makes the ultimate determination based upon the inherent authority of the court.
I could be wrong. I'll take a look at the case, but I don't know that the United States Code has a statute that reads in a way that's similar to 23A-35-4.1. That would make a difference.
That is correct. In other words, I believe that most of the federal law is based upon the common law and the First Amendment analysis. I would advise the court that my understanding is there are two states that have what would be similar statutes. One is California, and I would direct the court's attention specifically to People v. Jackson, 27 Cal Reporter, 3D596, where the Supreme Court, in looking at the language of a statute that says it's prohibited from disclosure, has said, no, we retain the inherent authority. And they specifically said part of the basis for keeping it sealed was privacy interests, which are significant in this case when you have an individual that's uncharged, unarrested, has significant privacy interests.
And I want to get to the other issues, too, and I'm sorry. I just want to get your thoughts on this. If our own rules seem to contemplate, as it seems like they do, and I'm looking at 1515A5, subsection 3, where it talks about the authority of an individual court or the prohibition, I'm sorry, upon an individual court adopting a more restrictive access policy or otherwise restricting access beyond that provided by statute or in this rule. So if the court has inherent authority, as you suggest, and has supremacy or preeminence, as I keep saying, does it seem like our rulemaking allows for, whether it has to or not, allows for other authorities to play a part in the access to information analysis in a given case?
I think play a part is a key word, and I think the answer to that is yes, and that's the allowing them to be in harmony or to coexist, because ultimately if you view that particular section that you referred to as complete prohibition, that would be an improper delegation. In other words, the legislature in Article 2 as well as Article 5, Section 12 is given certain authority, and it can't just divest itself of that authority. That would be an improper delegation. And in fact, as referenced by Justice Salter with respect to looking at other legislative provisions, SCCL 1-27-1.12, the legislature has specifically exempted from public records UJS records. And so those are yet another inconsistency. In the event that this court ultimately determines that it does not retain the inherent authority, the constitutional authority over its own records, we are requesting that prospective relief be applied. That issue clearly was not waived, despite what ProPublica has stated. It was raised. The trial court asked for more briefing on it. I'm citing record 405 on pages 456 through 57, as well as 61 through 63. I would ask this court to do the home analysis, which was Justice Kern as a trial judge, and looking at the decision establishes a new principle of law, because it clearly is overriding clear past precedences, and it is a case of first impression. Buchholz was the only time this court addressed this particular statute, and it was a context of defendant obtaining its records. And so based upon those reasons, we are specifically requesting that it be prospective application. And I would reserve the balance of my time if there are no further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Jacklin.
Thank you.
Mr. Beck, you may proceed. You have 10 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Jeff Beck. I represent ProPublica, one of the co-appellees in this case, along with Argus Leader, who's represented by John Arneson, and collectively, Judge Power referred to us as the press. And we've been sort of traveling on that path as the press. Justice Salter started out, gave a good introduction of how it was that we got here as far as the request for the search warrant. ProPublica had made the initial request to get the search warrant under what we feel this case is all about is a simple case of statutory interpretation. And when you look at the 23A35-4.1, that without equivocation is the governing law in this case. The inquiry ends there. When you look at 23A35-4.1, it specifically tells the court what authority they have with regards to a very specific record.
Does the court retain some authority, inherent or otherwise, to redact information? So this is Mr. Jackley's argument, and so does his view is if you read that statute exactly to mean what it says, then that would conceivably divest the court of the ability to even redact personal information, social security numbers, addresses, phone numbers, whatever might be in any given record.
And that would go similar along with Justice Devaney's question regarding is there a difference between redaction and sealing. We would, agree or concede that, they're totally different, that redaction and sealing are different, and that the court does have that ability to redact when you look at, again, Social Security numbers, infants' names. That statute, 2335A, actually addresses specifically the redaction issue when it talks about cases of alleged rape, incest, sexual contact, if the victim's a minor, that certain things will be redacted. So, yes, the legislature did understand and appreciate the redaction issue and actually put it into the statute.
So would it violate? So you're saying it would not, in your view at least, violate the provisions of 23A35-4.1 for a circuit court judge to go further and, though not, in the words of the statute, prohibiting disclosure of those discrete documents, but nevertheless acting to redact individual types of identifiers or information within those documents. That could happen or that couldn't happen?
I would argue that I would say that they could, because there are certain things that when we talk about individual personal identifying information, and I'm not talking name, I'll save that response regarding removing the defendant's name from a caption. Every justice that's on this bench sat in criminal court. Every one of you got called at 5 o'clock in the morning and did a search warrant. And at the top, state of South Dakota versus X, and we write in the person's name, defendant. Then we go down and it says concerning the matter of why, that is the what they did wrong. Then we go through. That's a constitution. It's under the Fourth Amendment. Who, what, where, what are we looking for? Who did what wrong and what crime did they commit? And so as far as taking out a name, Justice Salter, absolutely not. Would we agree that
yeah, and I wasn't even talking about the caption. Yeah. I was talking about within the body.
Like an IP address, for example. I didn't mean to interrupt the court.
Well, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I think I interrupted you. So the text of the statute, it's interesting. I don't know that it matters, but, you know, right after it says, it talks about sealing, and it uses that as a verb. The court can conceal, but only under certain circumstances. But then the text of the statute says that the court may not prohibit disclosure of the contents. So I don't know that that's significant or it is or it isn't, but that's how it says it. And I think that's the basis, I think that's what Mr. Jackley is driving at, is that if it says you can't prohibit disclosure of the contents, how could you ever do anything more, including redaction?
Again, looking for the harmony, if you look at, I think it's 15-15-87 that goes through the list and talked about what can and can't be removed. On the 15-15-87 list, it specifically says, you know, that the underlying affidavit, and that later on that can come out. As far as the ability to, I think that would be overreaching to say, oh, because that's what it says, that it can't release may not release the contents of the warrant, that simply couldn't go through and the court wouldn't have the ability to redact an IP address that now would be put out there for essentially public consumption for everybody or individuals. Email address or something, you know, telephone number for that matter, that I still think the court would have that ability to redact that very specific identifying information, and I think it's easy to divorce itself from that statute. The harmony that implicated individual alluded to between 15-15A and the 23-835, I think what you have to look at there, the harmony comes from the fact that 15-15A specifically addresses 23 and refers itself over there and says, if we look at that inquiry, it goes common law, well, constitution first, right? Then we go to statutory law and common law. The statutory law it's referring to is 23A35, which specifically says may not, you know, cover up the disclosure of these items, and they have to be out there.
Just so I'm clear on your argument, I thought I heard you say that the court would have inherent authority to allow or to order redaction of items beyond those that are specified in the various statutes.
Correct. The IP address, for example. The statute, it says, you know, in all cases of alleged rape, incest, there's very specific things that they want to make sure that you can't include, that you can't let those go out the door. But we would agree that, yes, the court still has the authority to go through and redact.
So where do you draw, how do we draw the line? And, you know, let's talk about the name. You know, obviously, that's
by statute. There's statutes that address those, Justice, where it talks about financial information, identifying information.
That was my question.
Correct.
Tying it to those.
That's in 15-15, where it talks about the redaction, what's allowed. So I think you have to. That's the harmony that I think Mr. Jackley's looking for. Is they've got that. The judge always has that authority to go through and redact those. And that discussion can be had in court, what should or should not be redacted. And, you know, our position is that the warrant should go out the door under the statute, those documents. And, again, one thing that I want to remind the justices here today, that we're not looking for that underlying warrant. We're looking for the warrant itself. And in this case, the return and inventory, which is, and these documents are forms that if you go through and in Appendix A of Chapter 23, it's, I think it's Forms 36 through 39, they're very specific. I mean, every circuit uses them, and we're asking for those forms that are presumptively public. The
what's your response to Mr. Jackley's litany of adverse consequences that will occur here should the court deem itself bound through the language of 23A 35.4.1 without this effort to harmonize with 1515A through inherent authority?
I would argue that the more absurd result would be to give implicated individual what he's asking for. Again, this isn't the government that's standing here looking for these to be sealed. This is the implicated individual. This is a citizen saying, I want my name removed from it because it's embarrassing. And if we go down that path, essentially the floodgates are going to open. The more absurd result that's going to happen is you're going to have every criminal defendant going to want to seal all these records for anything that they think is embarrassing. I mean, to me, that would be more absurd.
Does the reason for the request matter? Should it matter? So if it's not, if it's an investigation, a continuing investigation, which is, I think, Mr. Jackley started out with that premise. I don't want to be embarrassed. There is a potential continuing investigation that could be jeopardized. Does the matter and should or does the reason for the request matter?
I want to make sure I understand your question, Justice, is that for the request for the seal, as to why seal,
well,
right?
Let's just talk about redaction.
Okay.
The name redaction here.
Removed from the caption?
From the document that would be disclosed, wherever it appears.
Yes, that goes to the inquiry. So when the request is made, because, again, you've got a First Amendment premise that this is an open document. So when that request would get made under the 1515A, what is it, 15, I think, or 13, to remove part of it, it specifically says that what must occur is you must look at Constitution, then you go to statutory law, then you go to common law. And when you get to it, the reason for the request, it has to have, it's a very high standard, and it says a compelling governmental interest. And that's sort of what I was trying to stress with the court is the governmental
time
is not
is
make.
Up, Mr. Beck. No. Thank you. Mr. Arneson, you have 5 minutes.
May it please the court. John Arneson representing Argus Leader, one of the press here. I hate to be presumptuous here, but I would like to kind of redirect the court's attention to the fact that this is a case about 23A 35.4.1, it's really not a case about redaction. And while I can appreciate the court's interest in entertaining questions about redaction, we have a statute that's pretty clear, and it says this stuff is going to be open. The public has a right of access to it. And this body, the judiciary, separation of powers, none of that really imperils the gravity of that particular statute. Nobody's done anything to change it. So the point is, the statute sits there, raw, open, clear, plain. And it says, these are things that are going to be open to public inspection. Now, let's not downplay either, the value of public access. The right of the public to know what is going on in government, to know what you people are doing, to know what the legislature is doing, to know what the executive branch is doing. That's a pretty important right. Accountability and our right to know. Those aren't just procedural byproducts. Those are substantive matters. And I believe that this statute gave force to that and recognize that and said, in this instance, this is the way it's going to be. Now, we may not like that. Mr. Jackley may not like that. Other clients may not like that. People who have had their search warrants issued against them may not like that. But that's what the law says. And I don't know that we need to start worrying about redaction because that's not in the law. 15A came after that law. That law still sits there. Nobody's changed it. So let's assume Mr. Jackley is right and the judiciary does have total control over records, which I do not believe it does, because I think if we look at our separation of powers constitutional provision, as I pointed out in the brief, our legislative power is not a grant of power. The only thing the legislature can't do is going to be what it's restricted from doing. And there's no restriction here that they couldn't do this. So my point is, even under separation of powers, let's assume I'm wrong and the judiciary does have the power to say, no, we're not going to do that. It hasn't done that. That law still sits there. So that's what we have to go back to. This is a more basic case, I think, than we would maybe ever even have envisioned when it began. It was simply a mistake that was made by the circuit court, recognized by the circuit court when finally attention was drawn to the mistake. And he looked at it. Arguments were made. Briefs were submitted. And we don't care if it's implicated in individual A, John Doe, Jane Doe, Freddie Frank. The point is, we went, recognized that this should not have been done. The court said, oops, I shouldn't have done it that way. And honestly, we in the media, we don't know, and I don't know if the public knows, I don't know if this court knows what the history of following that statute has been. I honestly don't know. That's the problem with secrecy is, you know, we don't know. Maybe that's the practice that's been done. But the point is, it should not have been done that way. It was corrected and should remain corrected. Now, I've been in front of this body with a different constitution, and I've been told before on media cases, on access cases, when our law wasn't exactly favorable to public access, I've been told, Mr. Arneson, you make good points, but that's not what the law says. If you want to change it, go upstairs. Now, of course, we're on the fourth floor. Go upstairs to the legislature. And yeah, I chuckle and say, well, I can't be in two places at once. But my point is, that's what would have to happen here. If you don't like this law, if the implicated individual or Mr. Jackley or we don't like the law, change it.
Will you address the question of prospective application?
Yes, I would. This is not one of those situations in which this is simply a mistake of, as I said in the brief, 2 plus 2 does not equal 5. And people have been saying 2 plus 2 may have equaled 5. And now we've found out that, no, 2 plus 2 equaled 4. It equaled 4 in 1987. And from that point on, it should be 2 plus 2 equals 4. This statute should have been in effect the moment it was passed. And there's no reason why it would be considered prospective at this point. It's not the type of interpretation of an ambiguous it's not the typical statutory interpretation. It's a black and white issue. There's nothing gray here. So it's not the kind of thing that people easily could have been saying, well, this is the way we're going to apply a criminal law situation and, you know, have a nice dividing line between what, you know, notice. People would need notice. This is not one of those situations. People don't rely.
Mr. Anderson, your time's up. I think you've answered the question.
Okay.
Thank you.
5 minutes goes fast.
It does. Mr. Jackley, you have 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. To be very clear, if the court has authority to redact, it has authority to seal under SDCL 15-15A. The uncharged individual is not a defendant in this case. In fact, I made a specific discovery request to the state and was denied discovery because he's not a defendant, and the trial court agreed. And so if this rule were to be interpreted that way where there's no ability to redact, what would be released is a search warrant application that the state has admitted an error that will deeply affect private privacy interests.
Mr. Jackley, I'm sorry, but in the limited time you've got, I had a question on this prospective application, and you just touched on it at the end of your argument. 15 and 5, all those, the time periods go quickly. So before we go too much further, I know you're right when you say you made the argument, and I can read that and I can see that. What I don't know is whether we have an adverse order that we can review dealing with prospective application. And I think you seem to almost acknowledge in some of the later email chains that, you know, though it had been raised, you went ahead and filed a notice of appeal, which I understand why you did what you did. But your view was that, you know, probably the circuit court didn't have authority to act after that, which seems to me to acknowledge, you know, what seems obvious, which is there's no order from the circuit court that says, yes, I'm going to grant that, or no, I'm going to deny that. And obviously when we do appellate review, you know, one of the principal tenets is that we're reviewing an adverse order from the party that's appealing. I'm not sure if we have an order here or not.
You do not have an adverse order unless you want to interpret the trial court's ruling as that adverse order, because it didn't specifically say it would only be applied prospectively. But I would advise this court it doesn't need that adverse order, because this is a purely legal question as to whether or not it would be applied prospectively. And the reason, and I think the court alluded to it, the reason it wasn't decided is that an appeal had to be filed or the issues would have been waived. And so we were caught in that situation where trial court rules ultimately, once that ruling came down, it became obvious that there was a whether or not it was going to be applied retrospective issue. We ultimately immediately jumped on it, asked for briefing, but the time was up, in part because the orders were nunk-pro-tunk back to the date of the hearing. But again, this is a purely legal issue that this court can review, and as a court under Bogard and some of those other cases has the inherent authority to apply its rule of law or perspective in nature only, which this court should. As this court is well aware, in trial courts across the state, search warrant orders to seal are routinely granted. It happened in this case. And so this would be a case of first impression, completely changing the procedure and process across the state at the trial court level. And it's based upon that. It should, in the event that this court deems it does not have inherent authority, it should be applied only prospectively under the Holm test. Justice Devaney asked, you know, a question regarding the various reasons that there could be requests to seal matters, and the answer is those could be anything from naming a confidential informant to a continuing investigation to lacking further probable cause. There's a variety of reasons law enforcement, you know, may ultimately decide it wants, or there's a basis to seal documents or redact documents. And none of those are accounted for if this court interprets that its Supreme Court rules did not apply and allow to seal or redact. I know that that ProPublica urges this court to follow the statute, but clearly the Constitution trumps the statute, and clearly Supreme Court rules matter. You know, in looking at the case law and looking at Texas and looking at California, the only two states that have a similar statute, I think this case comes down to this. The uncharged individual urges this court to resist ProPublica's invitation to be the first court, to our knowledge, to divest itself of its authority over its own search warrant records. And it would be doing that in a case where you have an uncharged individual that has never been arrested. You have a situation where the state has admitted error in its search warrant application, at least with the caption. And I would urge this court, based upon your inherent authority and your constitutional authority, to allow these statutes to coexist and to send the matter back down to the trial court to address whether or not there exists proper basis to remain under seal. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Jackley. The case is now submitted. Thank you for your arguments in this case. They were helpful. The court will be in recess till 11 o'clock.